The next speaker, Mike Cassenda. He's an air racing historian. And to put it in very simple terms, Mike saw his first Cleveland air races in 1929, and he doesn't seem to have recovered. Mike?
How soon will you reach out for me with the hook?
Let me check my watch here. 4:20, go to 5 o'clock, 5:15.
We'll see if we can do it.
Okay.
As Don said earlier, somehow in the churly-burly of last night's meeting, I lost or misplaced my notes, so you'll have to excuse me on the dates a little bit. The 1932 Thompson Trophy race was pretty well dominated by Jimmy Doolittle and the R1 GB. And because of that, a lot of aviation buffs don't look further back into the field to see what some of the other airplanes were doing. Because of the torrential rains they had the Sunday before the Thompson was run, it was decided to eliminate the horse race start and start the airplanes off in 10-second intervals. The pilots drew numbers out of a hat and got their starting position that way. Bob Hall, who was flying the Bulldog, drew out number one. So he had a definite advantage to getting into the clear air all by himself. But by the time he had reached pylon number three on lap one, Jimmy Doolittle went by him in the R1. The interesting thing here is that many people thought that the Bulldog was powered by a Wasp Junior engine. Somehow this had gotten garbled in the Springfield newspapers. But in reality, the Bulldog was powered with the same T3 D1 special Wasp engine that the R1 had in it. Now, what went wrong here that caused the Bulldog to run so slow? Back when Bob Hall quit the Granville organization and started the Springfield Aircraft Company in the fall of 1931, somewhere around Thanksgiving Day is when he left. Pratt & Whitney, still wanting to have their engine dominate the Thompson Trophy race, couldn't very well ignore the two different factions here. The Granvilles had built the previous Thompson Trophy winner, and Bob Hall, on the other hand, in the Springfield outfit, now newly formed, had designed the GBZ that had won the 31 race. So what they did, they built up two special Wasp T3D1 engines, sent one to the Granvilles, sent one to Bob Hall at Springfield Aircraft. Now, I hope Harvey will back me up on this. There were some special parts that they put into the T3D1 modification. But it was rated at 730 horsepower, operating at 2,300 RPM. There have been all sorts of figures put out in the past, 800, 850 horsepower, but in reality, 730 was the power output. Along with the engine, Pratt & Whitney usually sent a representative to make sure that the engine was being installed correctly. A man named Eric Hoffman went to the Springfield Aircraft Company to take a look at Bob Hall's Bulldog as it was under construction. And Bob had this special exhaust system that he had a lot of faith in, where he was taking these curved pipes and poking them out the cowling skirt, hoping that the air rushing by the face of the cowling would suck the exhaust gases out of the engine, giving it a little better efficiency. In putting all this plumbing in underneath the cowling, Bob couldn't find enough room for the preheater that had been furnished with the T3D1 engine. This was a larger unit than the unit that went on the regular Wasp, and because the Bulldog was going to be entered in the Bendix race, flying over the Rockies, they felt a preheater was necessary to cut down on carburetor icing. So Bob substituted the smaller standard preheater onto the carburetor instead of the large unit. When Eric Hoffman saw this, he pointed out the fact that this was going to restrict the flow to the carburetor and he wouldn't be able to get max RPM. Well, Hall was a little pressed for time and he said he'd take his chances and hopefully the exhaust system might cover up whatever loss he had from the smaller preheater. The second thing that came into play here was the Hamilton standard two-position propeller that was furnished. This prop had two positions, high and low. You took off in low pitch while it was held there by oil pressure in the cylinder up front. Then the high pitch, which when the oil was released, the blades were rotated by counterweights up into the high pitch position. You could preset the limits on this prop on the ground before you started the engine. You could limit the high pitch and the low pitch. What they did was they set the prop up for max horsepower, 730, 2300 RPM. But since the engine was not getting the proper flow through the smaller preheater, the engine couldn't pull the propeller in high pitch, so the Bulldog lost speed and just couldn't compete with the R1. Now, to get a better perspective on this thing, I'd like to take you back to 1929 when the Granvilles were getting started in Springfield. They intended to manufacture the Model A biplane, and they found out very early in setting up the shop that a approved type certificate was necessary if you're going to build a commercial plane for sale. The president of the company, Zanford Granville, hadn't gone much beyond the eighth grade, and there was no one really in the organization that could generate the engineering data that you had to send to the Department of Commerce in order to get the ATC. So as a necessary evil, they hired a young engineer named Robert Hall to generate all this engineering data that was necessary to get the ATC for the biplane. Well, after building about 15 or 16 of these biplanes, the sales dried up on the thing, and it looked as though the Granvilles were going to have to go to an early closing of their doors. At that time, Bob Hall stepped forward. He had a series of low-wing designed airplanes that he thought might be able to keep the company together. And he was instrumental in forming the Springfield Air Racing Association to put up the money to finance this racing operation. They sold stock for $100 a share, and that way they got enough money to build the GBZ racing plane, which won the Thompson Trophy race. Right after the Thompson Trophy race, Bob Hall went to the Springfield Air Racing Association and suggested that they sell the Z while it was still the number one speed plane in the country. So they took out a full-page ad in Aviation Magazine offering the GBZ for sale for $18,500. They had a number of inquiries on the airplane, but nobody with some ready cash to pull this off. One of the major people interested in the Z was Ernst Udet. Udet had conferred with the Saucony Vacuum Oil Company and was hoping that they would put up the money to buy the Z. Just what he intended to do with that airplane, I don't know. But while he was carrying on this conference with the Saucony Vacuum people, Sanford Granville thought that he would go after the world's land plane speed record, something they missed doing at the national air races because they burned a couple of pistons and just couldn't get the thing repaired in time. What he did was he went to Pratt & Whitney and he wanted to get the larger 1,344 cubic inch WASP engine to use for the world speed record and replace the little WASP Junior that they had in the airplane. Now, this didn't go over too well with Bob Hall. As a matter of fact, he felt that he was sort of left out on this decision. And this sort of acted as the straw that broke the camel's back. He never got along with Sanford Granville very well because of the two different personalities. Bob Hall was a university graduate, and of course Sanford Granville came through the School of Hard Knocks. So Bob quit the company, and also he took with him the whole engineering staff. Bob Ayers, another engineer, Dave Bradford, the draftsman, and then out of the shop he took Andy Anderson, Dave's dad, and Frank Nelson, several other of the top workers in the Granville organization, and he felt certain that this would spell the end to the Granville organization since they didn't have an engineering staff and most of their key workers had been taken away. Well, he went across the river to Agawam, Bowles Field, and he set up the Springfield Aircraft Corporation there. Oh, let me backtrack just a minute here. Let me go back to 31. During the 1931 races, Bob Hall came up with the GBY and the Lowell Bales for the Z up from Springfield. But during the 10-day run of the air races, there was a Polish pilot named Bolesław Orlinski that flew a Polish fighter plane, the PZL-6. Could we get to that?
It's on your board right there on the podium. Well, that's in front of your hand.
Oh, okay. Very good. Orlinski would put on this show with this all-metal gull-wing airplane each day. And one of the most impressive things he did with that airplane was turn it up on knife edge and do an outside circle in front of the grandstand about 50 foot above the deck. And the airplane didn't seem to lose any altitude while it was doing this. Bob Hall was impressed by this, and he thought that the gull configuration of the wing was the secret to the airplane's stability when it was doing this tight circle. So he thought that, indeed, if you're going to build a winning race plane, this was the way to go with a high gull wing. So starting his new company, he laid out several gull wing airplanes. One, of course, was the Thompson Racer, and that's exactly what they called it, a Thompson Racer on all the drawings that Bradford made. The other one was a smaller version of the same airplane to be powered with a Warner 110 horsepower engine. And this he hoped to sell to various sportsman pilots. It would be the same as the old Granville Model C's and D's, a little single place airplane that guy could have a lot of fun with. He estimated the selling price to be around $4,500. $1,500 of that would be the cost of the Warner engine. And in starting the company, he also started a mechanics school, aircraft mechanics school. For $50, you could enroll in this school and learn how to be an aircraft mechanic. And he had several kids enroll right off the bat with their $50. And these people became sort of the nucleus of the working force that was going to build these airplanes. The people he brought over from Granville sort of acted as the lead men. Andy Anderson became the shop foreman that ran the whole operation. They started to build the little Warner powered airplane, and it was a kind of a nice learning project for the kids. And then on top of that, it would serve as a kind of a test plane to see what the flight characteristics were before launching into the Bulldog, in case there were some modifications that had to be made to the basic design. I forgot to mention that back at the 31 races, as he was watching the PZL-6 go through its paces, young Russell Thaw, then 20 years old, talked to Bob and asked him various questions about racing and what would it cost to build a racing plane. Well, Hall didn't take him very seriously. He said, well, it cost about $1,500 to develop a first-rate, $15,000 to develop a first-rate racing plane. And sort of forgot about this. And later on, Russ did indeed show up at the Springfield Aircraft Place asking more about the airplane. But in the meantime, a man named Frank Lynch came into the picture. Lynch was a former World War I aviator, and after the war, he'd made a sizable fortune developing toothpaste tubes and the machinery to manufacture toothpaste tubes. At the age of about 35, he sold the company, retired, and then decided that he was going to get back into flying again. And he came to Bob Hall and wanted Hall to build him an airplane that he could take his wife on a trip around the world. Of course, he didn't mean to fly across the oceans. He'd take the airplane across by boat, but he'd do flying through Europe and Russia and that sort of thing. So Bob put forward the what was then known as the L-1, later to become the Cicada. This was a high-wing airplane, but they deleted the gull portion of the thing to cut the expenses down on the thing. Initially, the publicity that came out in the Springfield newspapers on the Cicada said that a right whirlwind would be the engine to power the airplane. Well, of course, Pratt & Whitney, hearing this, contacted Bob and said you'd be better off using a Wasp Junior in that airplane than a Wright, which he did. And a rather unusual thing about the Cicada design was that the side-by-side seating in the open cockpit was staggered. The passenger on the right-hand side was about a foot back from the pilot, so that the shoulder room was a little freer for the pilot. This was a thing copied from the two-man Indianapolis cars, where they used a staggered seating position back in the 30s. Lynch was living in Summit, New Jersey, but as soon as I got started on the Cicada, he moved down to Agawam and pretty well stuck around the plant while they were building the airplane. He enjoyed talking to the people working on the airplane and telling them war stories and that sort of thing. And he was a kind of a big spender, so everybody kind of enjoyed rubbing elbows with him. But he wanted the airplane in June so he could start this trip around the world. But somewhere his planning went off because his wife became pregnant, and that sort of rubbed out the world tour in the airplane. So when the airplane was finished, Bob Hall test flew the thing in the morning on a Saturday, and then again Sunday morning, and flew up to Niagara Falls for an air race that was going on there. He thought he'd just test out the cicada. It was a big airplane, not really a pylon racer, but he was anxious to see what it would do. And there were two events up there, a 20-mile event and a 50-mile event. Russ Boardman took both events in the GBY, and Bob Hall ended up in fourth position. So the airplane really didn't perform that red hot, but he thought for a race like the Bendix cross country, the airplane might be better suited. So he began to talk to Frank Lynch about entering the airplane in the Bendix race. And the little time that Lynch had put into the airplane initially, flight-wise, he just couldn't get the sort of confidence in his ability to handle this hot airplane. His last flying experiences were in World War I, and this was quite a departure, handling a rather high-performance airplane. So he busied himself making touch-and-go landings there at Bowles Field. Bob Hall got busy building the V-2, which would later become the Bulldog. And about the time that they got the airplane pretty well underway, Russ Thaw showed up, reminding Hall that he'd talked to him at the 31 air races and was interested in buying an airplane now. Bob said he couldn't build him another airplane, but he would sell him the airplane he had under construction now for about $15,000. Well, another thing that Thaw wanted was to enter the plane in both the Thompson and the Bendix. Now, initially, the Bulldog hadn't been designed for the Bendix, and the thinking was then that the fewer stops you made in the Bendix, the better off you would be. So Hall figured the way to fly the Bendix would be to make one refueling stop. So he went back and did some modifications to the Bulldog under construction at the time, and he put two side tanks on the airplane, 73 gallons apiece. This was in addition to the 25-gallon tank ahead of the instrument panel and the 45-gallon tank underneath, which brought the fuel capacity up to about 215 gallons, something that he hadn't figured on in the original design. But anyway, the interesting thing there was that in spite of the fact that the airplane looks quite round, the main fuselage structure, the welded steel tubing, was only about 20 inches wide, enough to get the pilot into it, and then up front the internally sprung landing gear. Other than that, the internal part of the fuselage was pretty empty. The fuel tanks were all hung on the outside of the fuselage. In fact, if we could get to the...
Right here, Mike.
Oh. Oh, okay, fine.
Something up there.
Yeah. Oh, here's the PZL-6.
What was that man's name again?
Boris.
The man is living in a nursing home up in Toronto right now. He's a retired cab driver. After having fought in the Battle of Britain, flying Hurricanes and Spitfires, kind of a come down to be a cab driver in Toronto, but had a tremendous amount of ability to handle this airplane. You'll notice
around the outer part of the cowl, the exhaust pipe sticking out. Now this is what gave Bob Hall the idea for the exhaust system on the Bulldog, except he went one step better by cutting the pipes off flush on the Bulldog, which gave it an even better scavenging effect. Oh, here we are, a close-up of the... this was a Bristol Jupiter engine in the PZL-6. This particular airplane was the prototype, and a lot of this metal was hand-hammered, and you can see the scroll marks on there to cover up the hammer finish. This is the group after the Bulldog was rolled out of the Springfield Aircraft hangar. The man in the white coveralls there is Frank Lynch. The man next to him in the dark jacket is a treasurer of the company. And the rest of these people here, some of them are students, and some of them are the men that came over from Granville. Dave, could you pick out your dad in this shot?
Yes, he's got number six. The picture's backwards, but...
Oh, it is, okay.
He's got number six on the fuselage sticking out of his ear there.
Okay, okay. Yeah. That's Andy Anderson.
That's 21 or
22. Mm-hmm. The second man from the right there kneeling is a guy named Richard Schneelock. He's out in San Diego now working for the Navy, a civilian employee. He sent me a lot of information on the Bulldog. He recalls that as a student, he worked on the smaller airplane, the Warner-powered plane, and also worked on the wing panels of the Bulldog and the Cicada. Here's a shot of the Bulldog with the big fin and rudder now. The way this came about, initially, on the first test flight of the Bulldog, Bob Hall went to do a left bank. He shoved the stick over to the left, and the airplane went the other way. So he thought at first that somehow they'd hooked up the aileron controls backwards and sort of eased the plane back into the field, and they made a check and found that everything was hooked up correctly. But what was happening was the ailerons were twisting the wing. So what they did was they eliminated the up motion, mostly, on the ailerons, and they just used down motion to keep from twisting the wing too severely. But the first modification they made was a slightly larger rudder. I don't know whether we've got a shot of that or not. Yeah, here it is. The fin remained the same, but the rudder was bigger. And after doing the test flight on this, Hall thought the airplane just handled perfectly. It was a much more docile airplane than the old Z was. To backtrack again a little bit here, when Thaw brought the down payment for the airplane to Springfield Aircraft Corporation, he also had a contract that Mrs. Guggenheim had her lawyers draw up, and it had a lot of fine print in it. Usually a race plane project back in the 30s was consummated by a handshake and away you went. But in this case, there was a bona fide contract, and it stated that this airplane had to be delivered by the 16th of August. If it was later than that, it would suffer a $1,000 penalty. So Hall was anxious to turn this plane over to Thaw, but because of this directional stability thing, Spaugh sort of held off on the thing, wanting to make sure the airplane was absolutely perfect before he accepted the thing. But, here's the cicada. You can, I don't know whether you can see the staggered arrangement of the cockpit or not. George Agnoli, who was a sign painter in Springfield, did some of the decorative painting on the GBZ, the R1 and the R2, came over to do this paint job for Bob Hall, also did the paint job on the Bulldog. But you can see that there's no go in the cicada wing. Well, this is the thing with the final rudder. Yeah, this was a hurry-up job. And there's probably a lot more area here than was really necessary. But the clock was running very fast about the time they were forced to do this. And they just added a lot of area for good measure, hoping to get Thaw to accept the airplane and get their money. There it is again. Here it is taken with a filter, and you can see the different colors. Oh. I included this drawing. It was done by Dave Bradford, the chief draftsman of the Springfield outfit. And it appears to be the Bulldog as we know it. But if we look closely at this thing, you'll see it has the first rudder modification. And it also has a kind of a swept back leading edge on the thing. Unfortunately, this is backwards. But the date on this drawing was August 20th, I think. This was long after the airplane had flown already. So what this drawing shows were the modifications that they hoped to make to the airplane sometime, but unfortunately time ran out on them. And of course they couldn't redo the wing anymore. There are people that argue that this is the way that the wing was actually configured on the Bulldog, but then there's a faction of people that say no, it was not swept back and the spars were parallel. I've witnessed Bob Hall saying yes to both drawings, so you can take your choice there, but I'm on the side of the no sweep back thing. One of the reasons for the sweepback was that the Bulldog, right from the very start, showed a kind of a tail-heavy tendency, and it was kind of difficult to get the tail up on takeoff, and usually Bob Hall took it off in a kind of a three-point position. So I think maybe this sweepback was incorporated in order to bring the center of lift back to kind of subdue the tail heaviness of the airplane. Well, that's a top view again. You can get a good look at the two-position Hamilton standard prop here. Here's the oil cylinder, and the counterweights are on each side of the hub here. An interesting thing, now that Harold Smith was here talking about the GBs and the Smith prop, when the R1 and the R2 arrived in Cleveland, they took the Hamilton standard props like these off of the airplanes, and on Jimmy Doolittle's advice, they put a Smith propeller on both the R1 and the R2. So when Bob Hall compared notes with Jimmy Doolittle on the performance of the engine, knowing they both had the same engine. Jimmy Doolittle said that he was easily getting 2,300 RPM out of his and thought maybe he might be able to get even more, whereas Hall was barely getting 2,000 out of his with the two-position prop. So you wonder if Hall had had a variable pitch propeller like the Smith, he might have been able to cover up the fact that the engine wasn't really putting out. But that's the breaks of the game. This is taken at Cleveland. Oops. Another game with a filter. I don't know what we're looking at here. That's again Dave Bradford's drawing. I think this is the underside of the airplane, right at the landing gear position. You can just barely see the scoop at the top that was connected to this preheater I was talking about. I don't know what we're looking at here. There's another shot of the cicada. This also had a two-position Hamilton standard. Okay, I think that's about it. Let me just go back for effect here. Anyway, about the third test flight that Bob Hall made in the Bulldog, the ship did this violent half roll to the left, and he was able to chop the throttle and managed to pick the wing up enough to put the thing down on the ground. And of course, Russ Thaw, watching this from the ground, wasn't too encouraged seeing this airplane do this dido on takeoff. And in taxiing back to the hangar, the left tire blew out on the Bulldog, so they had to replace the tire and all that. But I really didn't know what caused the roll. And again, Thaw was very undecided on whether he was going to accept this airplane. And already the 16th had passed, and Hall had taken the $1,000 penalty. Russ Thaw was based at Roosevelt Field, and they had a kind of a pilot's lounge at Roosevelt Field for a lot of freelance test pilots. So he prevailed upon Jimmy Collins to come down to Agawam and take a look at this Bulldog. Well, Collins agreed to take the thing up and feel it out, and he flew it around for about 20 minutes doing some mild aerobatics on the thing. He landed, told the reporters from the Springfield newspapers he thought it was a swell airplane, handled very nicely. But in my correspondence with the late Russ Thaw before he died, he said that Collins told him that the airplane was pretty squirrely and he should be very careful, which again didn't encourage Russ Thaw too much. Let me go back to Mrs. Guggenheim here a little bit. Springfield newspapers at first printed that Mrs. Harry Guggenheim had furnished the financial backing for the Bulldog. Now, this wasn't true. Harry Guggenheim, who had started the Guggenheim Foundation for the Promotion of Aeronautics, and he was very active helping out various factions of aviation with the Guggenheim money. But he wasn't about to invest in a racing plane. Anyway, he was a staunch supporter of then-President Herbert Hoover. And in return for his support of Herbert Hoover, the president appointed Harry Guggenheim ambassador to Cuba, which took him out of the picture. His cousin, Edmund Guggenheim, fancied himself as a kind of a golfer and turned professional. Indeed, he was a good golfer. And he resigned from the Guggenheim Empire at the age of 35 to devote his life to playing golf. So he was traveling all over the country. You putting out the hook for me?
They're getting kind of anxious to turn this place into a dining room.
Okay, great.
He winded up.
Did
Phil ever buy it or didn't he?
No. But the interesting thing that happened here, with the clock running so fast, there was only a short time before the August 27th, the start of the National Air Races. And while the airplane was under construction, they had to submit a paper to the Department of Commerce to get the airplane registered. In order to do this, you had to send along a title to the airplane. So they signed Russell Thaw in as the owner of the airplane, although all they had was the down payment for the airplane. So officially, Russ Thaw was the owner of the airplane, regardless of the fact he hadn't paid the rest of the money. You want to break this thing off now?
Well, if you can, yeah.
To make a long story short, the newspapers were hounding Russ Thaw to find out whether he was indeed going to fly this airplane on the Bendix or not. And he would not give a statement, which kept everybody on the hook. Then, finally, as time was running out, he decided that, no, they couldn't get the airplane ready in time to fly it out to the West Coast for the Bendix race. Fortunately, Juke Pluvius stepped in here, and these torrential rains started. So they got a telegram from Pop Cleveland up here saying that they were going to postpone the Bendix for 2 days. It wouldn't start till the 29th. So this sort of turned the picture around. Indeed, what Russ Thaw said, it looked like it was possible now to get the airplane out to the West Coast for the Bendix. Well, Russ was still noncommittal on the thing, and finally, early one morning on the 20, I have my notes here, don't hold me to this, I think it was the 26th, the airplane was flown up to Roosevelt Field to have the instruments calibrated, the compass and that sort of thing, and for the first time, they loaded the plane up with the full capacity of fuel, 215 gallons. It had never flown with this much gasoline. Russ got in the airplane and started down the runway, and he couldn't, of course, get the tail up. And finally, as he ran out of runway, he chopped the throttles, aborted, taxied back, and tried it again. Didn't make it. Came back, jumped out of the airplane, told the newsmen that gathered around him that this wasn't his idea of a racing plane, it was a poor design, blah, blah, blah. So that left Bob Hull standing there with his mouth hanging open. He had lined up a man named Myers, a Canadian, not the Myers that was with Great Lakes and Waco, to, just in case this happened, to take over for Thaw. But knowing the legal entanglements here, Myers backed out of the thing. He didn't want to get in any kind of a lawsuit, stealing an airplane, that sort of thing. So Bob drained the 273-gallon side tanks on the Bulldog, flew it back to Agawam. He had a conference with his treasurer and some of the men in the company, came out with a hat full of money, jumped in the Bulldog, flew it back up to Roosevelt Field, went to see Mrs. Guggenheim, hoping to buy the airplane back for just the down payment she had put down. Well, she refused. She wouldn't sell the airplane.
Some people say that he actually got permission from Mrs. Guggenheim to fly the plane at the Cleveland Air Races. Other people say he didn't. But anyway, he did indeed fly to Cleveland and flew the plane in the dismal sixth place in the Thompson and sixth place in the Shell Speed Dashes. Except for Bill Long, he would have ended up in last place in the Thompson. But finally, after the Thompson, Mrs. Guggenheim's legal people caught up with him, and they told him that the airplane had to be destroyed. They weren't going to take any responsibility for anyone that was killed in the thing. And beside that, Mrs. Guggenheim and Russ Thaw wanted to fly down to Rio de Janeiro. And they had bought a used Lockheed Vega for the flight. It had a worn-out right whirlwind engine in it, and they needed an engine for the Lockheed Vega. So they shipped the Wasp out of the Bulldog back to Pratt & Whitney. They derated the thing to a commercial rating, shipped it to Burbank, and it was put in the Lockheed Vega so that the two could fly off together to Rio de Janeiro. The two-position propeller, in 1933, he leased to the Granville brothers in return for the chance to fly the R2 in the Bendix race. And the rest is history. Everything ended in Indianapolis for both airplanes. So,
whatever happened to the Bulldog?
It was chopped up the day after the Thompson here in Cleveland.
Did anything survive, any pieces?
The cowling and the cockpit enclosure, some of the metal parts went to Cleveland Model Supply. They had them on exhibit at the model store for a while. Then Hall, to the best of my knowledge, never got paid for the airplane other than the down payment. Any other questions before we eat? Thank you. I wish I could have gone into the romance portion of this thing a little more. There was a kind of a hot divorce suit that occurred later on. Russ Thaw was named as the one that alienated Edmund Guggenheim's wife's affections. Anyway,
well, next time. Well, thank you very, very much, Mike. Sorry we had to cut you off, but we're